Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover Ezekiel chapter 24, which I will entitle The Siege of Jerusalem. That's the final siege in 586. We have a date reference here in verse 1. In the ninth year, in the tenth month, on the tenth day, the word of the Lord came to me. Now, that's a solid date. It's measured from the time of Jehoiachin's captivity and Ezekiel's exile into Babylon, which was 597. You take 9 years from that in the ninth year, and you end up at 589, which is close enough to 588, because you have to account for fractions of the years at the beginning and ending of the date range. And we end up at 588, which is the year the commonly accepted that Nebuchadnezzar started the siege of Jerusalem. So now Ezekiel is prophesying during the siege. The siege has begun. Now the dating of previous prophecies of Ezekiel goes like this, verses 1 through 23. The date range is somewhere between 593 and 591. And so now we shift to right up to 588, right when the siege is beginning. Now the 10th month, that's Tebet, December or January in the winter. And God says in verse 1, in the ninth year, in the 10th month, on the 10th day, the word of the Lord came to me. Verse 2, son of man, record this date, this very date. So God points out the date, ninth year, 10th month, 10th day, as being very, very important. As John Gill says, the prophet is bid to observe it punctually and write it exactly, that there might be no mistake, to set it down in his pocketbook, or it may be in some public register, that it might not only be remembered by him, but known by the people, that so, when they should hear the fact afterwards related and exactly agreeing with his prediction, they would acknowledge him to be a true prophet. Well, it would not be a prediction of the beginning of the siege, because the siege has already started, but the predictions of what follow, namely the destruction of Jerusalem, would be quite accurate. Now, this date is recorded in other places in the Old Testament. I'll read those scriptures to you, and in them we will see that Nebuchadnezzar probably started the siege in person and afterwards left the siege in charge to his chief general, Nebuzaradan. So we read in 2 Kings 15:1, in the ninth year of Zedekiah's reign, on the 10th day of the 10th month, that's the exact same date that Ezekiel is talking about here in Ezekiel 24, verse 1, King Nebuchadnezzar, going back to 2 Kings 25, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon advanced against Jerusalem with his entire army. They laid siege to the city and built a siege wall against it all around. Jeremiah 39, verse 1, in the ninth year of Zedekiah of Judah, in the 10th month, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon advanced against Jerusalem with his entire army and laid siege to it. Now, Jeremiah in chapter 39 does not mention the 10th day, but he does mention the ninth year and the 10th month. Jeremiah, however, does mention the 10th day in Jeremiah 52, verse 4, in the ninth year of Zedekiah's reign, on the 10th day of the 10th month, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon advanced against Jerusalem with his entire army. Now, Jeremiah says it's the ninth year of Zedekiah's reign. Zedekiah began ruling the same year, 597, that Ezekiel and the other nobles went into exile into Babylon. So, on this very day, God tells Ezekiel, the king of Babylon has laid siege to Jerusalem. Now, verse 3 and verse 4 and verse 5, tell this rebellious house, God tells Ezekiel, tell this rebellious house a parable and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Put on the cooking pot, put it on and pour water into it. Put into it the pieces of meat, all the choice pieces, the leg and the shoulder. Fill it with the best of these bones. Take the pick of the flock. Pile wood beneath it for the bones. Bring it to a boil and cook the bones in it. Now this metaphor is pretty obvious. It's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. The pot is Jerusalem, which is going to get heated up. It will be a hot pot. And in the pot are the people of Jerusalem. They're getting boiled. Now, Jeremiah also saw a boiling pot, a little bit different metaphor, in Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 13. Again, the word of the Lord came to me inquiring, what do you see? And I replied, I see a boiling pot, its lip tilted from the north to the south. But this is referring to the Babylonian army coming out of the pot, coming from the north to the south. Some people have speculated that Ezekiel might be referring to that pot that was mentioned in Jeremiah chapter 1. I don't think so, because the interior of the pots were different. Here in Ezekiel, what's in the pot is the people of Jerusalem. Water is poured into the pot. That means the water is put there to distribute the heat evenly so the cooking will be done better. That's an incidental detail. Verse 4, put into the pot pieces of meat, all the choice pieces. Now, what does choice pieces mean? And also at the end of verse 4, fill it with the best of these bones. I'm assuming it's the bones with the meat on the bones, the leg and the shoulder bones. Why choice? Why best? Probably Ezekiel is referring to the royalty, the nobles, the military leaders, and so forth, and perhaps the strongest of the common people. Here's what Barnes says about that. The choice meat, the best meat, refers to the choice members of the community. Here's what Benson says. The choice meat, the best meat, the best bones, the choice pieces, refers to, quote, the wealthiest and chief of the inhabitants of the land seem to be met, who would flee from their country houses to live in safety in Jerusalem, and by the choice bones, the bravest and strongest among the common people, or the most warlike, who would betake themselves to the city for its defense. Well, I don't know if I would split out the difference between the choice pieces and the best bones, choice pieces being the aristocrats from the countryside coming into Jerusalem, and the best bones being the common people who fought. Let's just say it means the cream of Jewish society is going to get boiled. And, of course, if the cream of Jewish society is going to get boiled, that means the whole nation is gone, and the common people are going to suffer just as much. Verse 5, God says to Ezekiel, take the pick of the flock. Now, this is all a parable, of course. This is not actually going to be done. Take the pick of the flock. Again, the idea of nobility, the top dogs of Jewish society. Pile wood beneath it for the bones. You have to have wood to produce heat. Bring it to a boil. That means you have to light the wood, bring the water to a boil, cook the bones in it. What a great metaphor. Ezekiel 24, verses 6 through 8, we continue. For this is what the Sovereign Lord says. God is still speaking to Ezekiel. Woe to the city of bloodshed, to the pot now encrusted, whose deposit will not go away. Now that's a problematic translation. I'll just tell you right now, we'll talk about that in just a minute. Empty it piece by piece, empty the pot piece by piece, without casting lots for them. For the blood she shed is in her midst. She poured it on the bare rock. She did not pour it on the ground, where the dust would cover it. To stir up wrath and take revenge, I put her blood on the bare rock, so that it would not be covered. Now God, in verse 6, calls Jerusalem the city of bloodshed. If you recall two chapters previous, in Ezekiel 22, Jerusalem is called a city of bloodshed many, many times, all the way through the chapter. Because not only did the Jerusalemites commit adultery, they were killing people, probably through judicial murder. However they were doing it, doesn't matter. They did enough of it to where the city was known for murder. Now at the end of verse 6, we come to the problematic translation. The NIV has, woe to the pot now encrusted. Well, what does encrusted mean? Well, there's two options, two basic options. The pot either has scum on it or it has rust inside of it. Let's look at option number 1. John Gill holds to this option. He says that the word refers to scum on top of the pot that rises when you cook meat. And as that scum boils over the top of the pot, it will augment the fire. Well, that's fine, but what does the scum refer to? Well, let's look at some commentators. Joseph Benson says it refers to filthiness or wickedness, which is not purged out of the pot. The filthiness and wickedness being the filthiness and wickedness of the Jews in Jerusalem. Here's what Poole says. The scum in the pot refers to filthiness, Jerusalem's abominations, all her lewdness are still within her. They have not been punished, restrained, or cast out by the execution of just and good laws, but the citizens have with obstinacy, impenitence, and with impudence continued in them. So when the NIV says the deposit will not go away, a better translation in my humble opinion would be the scum is not gone away. The scum is referring to the scumbags who are now ruling Jerusalem. Now let's look at some translations which have scum. The KJV, the Darby Note, Marginal Note has scum. The Young's Literal Translation has scum. The other option is that this deposit, this stuff that has encrusted the pot, is rust inside the pot. Let me give you a translation that has it that way, the Holman Christian Study Bible. Therefore, this is what the Lord God says. Woe to the city of bloodshed, the pot that has rust inside it, and whose rust will not come off. Empty it piece by piece. lots should not be cast for its contents. So this option, instead of having scum on top of the meat inside the pot, has rust along the inside walls of the pot. Other translations that have rust are the American Standard Version, the Darby Version, the Holman Christian Study Bible Version, and I just read that, the New American Bible. Let's look at some commentators. Barnes thinks that rust is better than scum. Ellicott says this, quote, "This wickedness is so great that the city itself, represented by the cauldron, the pot, the city itself is, as it were, corroded with rust. It is therefore to be utterly destroyed." So there are your two options with good scholarly authority on both sides. I see a problem with saying that the word that refers to the deposit inside the pot should be rust. It seems to me that's a problem because the pot was made of a metal that doesn't rust. We look at Ezekiel 24, verse 11, first part of the verse in this chapter. "Set the empty pot on its coals so that it becomes hot and its copper glows." Copper is the pot, as translated by the Holman Christian Study Bible in God's Word translation. The KJV has, "Then set it, the pot, empty upon the coals thereof, that the brass of it may be hot and may burn." So the KJV has brass instead of copper. So does the ASV, American Standard Version, the Bible in Basic English, the Darby Translation, the King James Version, and the Young's Literal Translation all have brass. Well, the New American Bible, the Catholic Translation, they punt. They say, "Then I will set the pot empty on the coals till its metal glows red hot." Doesn't tell us what kind of metal it is. The New American Standard has, "Then set the pot empty on its coals so that it may be hot and its bronze may glow." So the pot is either copper, brass, or bronze, or some unknown metal. I'm sure it's a translation issue. Well, if it's copper, or if it's bronze, or if it's brass, those three metals do not rust. Again, to really knock down the idea that it's rust inside the pot, I would have to have a better understanding of Hebrew, and I don't think anybody has that kind of understanding to know exactly what the metal of that pot is. However, it does sort of push me away from the idea that the deposit in the pot is rust. I like scum better because it stands for scumbags. Now this pot is going to be empty it piece by piece. In other words, each piece of the meat that's in the pot get poured out on the ground. Remember, those pieces of meat stand for the Jerusalemites. Empty it piece by piece without casting lots for them. What does that mean? Well, the reference is to casting lots in order to save some. Are we going to save this piece of meat, or are we going to not save this piece of meat? No, we're not going to cast lots because nobody's going to be saved. Everybody is going to die. Verse 7, "For the blood she shed is in her midst." Once more, a reference to the city of bloodshed, Jerusalem. "She poured it," Jerusalem poured the blood of her victims, "on the bare rock. She did not pour it on the ground where the dust would cover it." Now, what does this mean? Well, pouring blood of your victims on a bare rock means that Jerusalem gloried in the murders. She didn't try to hide her murders. Ellicott and Poole say that, and I think that's accurate. So she pours the blood on a bare rock. She didn't pour it on the ground. What happens when you pour it on the ground? Well, the ground will soak up the blood. You can't see it anymore. But no, Jerusalem's proud of her murder. She puts it on bare rock because rock is hard. It won't soak up the blood. She did not pour it on the ground where the dust would cover it. And of course, covering blood was required by the law. I'm going to read you six scriptures referring to that. Leviticus 17:13. "Any Israelite or foreigner living among them who hunts down a wild animal or bird that may be eaten must drain its blood and cover it with dirt." I suppose I'll stop right now and ask why. What's the point of covering blood that's spilled on the ground with dirt, whether it's a human blood or whether it's a wild animal? Well, let me give you some options as to why. Here's some options as to what was the purpose of the law's legal commands. Option number one, so that blood might not be eaten by men. This is John Gill and Joseph Benson choose that option. They said this would show disrespect by eating blood, because blood, of course, is where the life is, and blood had to be offered up life for life. It was central to the Old Testament Levitical cult. It was central to the Old Testament Levitical ritual, showing that blood must be shed for the sacrifices of sin. If you just allow blood to lie down on the ground, that's not showing respect for the blood. Option number two, blood should be soaked up by the earth so beast might not lick it up, as John Gill says. And of course, that is the same as option number one. If men eat it, that shows disrespect. And if beast lick it up, that shows disrespect of the blood. Option number three is from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. So that blood might not be poured out as a libation to the god of the chase. Apparently that was some ritual they did back then. According to those commentators, they say that this was customary with heathen sportsmen. That sounds reasonable, but I'm not sure that's the reason why God said, cover the blood with the dirt. Benson suggests option number four, that covering blood up with dirt was to give men a horror of bloodshed. We don't want to look at blood that's been shed. Cover it up. It's a horrible thing to look at. That's reasonable, too. Well, for whatever reasons, blood was to be covered, and the Jerusalemites, when they killed their people, they didn't do it. Of course, the murder is worse than not covering the blood up, but still, it's mentioned. Ezekiel mentions it. You didn't pour it on the ground where the dust would cover it. All right, going back to our verses that say that blood must be covered by dirt, or at least imply that, I've read Leviticus 17:13. Let's read Deuteronomy 12:24. Do not eat blood. Pour it on the ground like water. And of course, I assume the intention here is that the blood will sink into the ground. You pour it on a rock, it won't sink into the rock. If you pour it on a rock, it will not sink into the rock. But if you pour it on the ground, it will sink into the ground like water. Leviticus 4:7, the priest must apply some of the blood to the horns of the altar of fragrant incense that is before the Lord in the tent of meeting. That's the golden altar. He must pour out the rest of the bull's blood at the base of the altar of burnt offering that is at the entrance to the tent of meeting. So there's blood left over from the ritual sacrifice. You have to pour it on the ground so that it gets soaked up. Deuteronomy 12:16, but you must not eat the blood poured on the ground like water. And that's referring to animals that are eaten for food, like a gazelle or something that you cook to eat for common food, not a sacrifice, but an animal eaten for food. When you slaughter it, you have to cover the blood up. You don't just leave it on the ground. Job 16:18, Job says, earth, do not cover my blood. May my cry for help find no resting place. Again, the idea, you keep the blood out there where everybody can see it, then it's not hidden. And so God can look down and say, somebody's blood is crying out for vengeance, for my vengeance. And that's what Job is saying. Don't cover up my blood so that people can't see it. That was the typical place where you put blood, is in the ground. Cover it up. Isaiah 26:21, for look, the Lord is coming from his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity. The earth will reveal the blood shed on it and will no longer conceal her slain. So there, the practice of covering up blood will not prevail. The earth will reveal the blood that has been shed on it. Similar idea here. In verse 8, God says this, to stir up wrath and take revenge, I will put her blood on the bare rock. Now, this is not the blood of the victims of the Jerusalemites. This is Jerusalem. Her blood is metaphorically put on a bare rock. So the rock will not soak up the blood, and so God will be able to see it. God says, I put her blood on the bare rock so that it would not be covered. In other words, so that the blood will stay there so I can stir up wrath and take revenge because of that blood. It's not going to be covered up. It's going to be brought to light. So far we have some easy metaphors here, very descriptive metaphors. We go now to Ezekiel 24, verses 9 through 14. Therefore, this is what the Sovereign Lord says, woe to the city of bloodshed. I too will pile the wood high. So heap on the wood and kindle the fire. Cook the meat well, mixing in the spices, and let the bones be charred. Then set the empty pot on the coals till it becomes hot and its copper glows so its impurities may be melted and its deposit burned away. It has frustrated all efforts. Its heavy deposit has not been removed, not even by fire. Now your impurity is lewdness, because I tried to cleanse you, but you would not be cleansed from your impurity. You will not be clean again until my wrath against you has subsided. I, the Lord, have spoken. The time has come for me to act. I will not hold back. I will not have pity, nor will I relent. You will be judged according to your conduct and your actions, declares the Sovereign Lord. Now in verse 9, God says, woe to the city of bloodshed. Ah, that old name for Jerusalem, as I said, all the way through chapter 22, city of bloodshed. I too will pile the wood high. That refers to the Babylonian army, which is going to be very, very strong in 586. A high wood pile produces a lot of heat, and the Babylonians are going to burn the city of Jerusalem to the ground. Verse 10, heap on the wood, kindle the fire, cook the meat well. That's the people of Jerusalem are going to be cooked well, well done, mixing in the spices. What are the spices? Well, that would be plunder. It's one thing to want to eat meat, but the meat will be spiced because the people that are going to be killed in the siege are going to have a lot of gold and silver and such. And so that the plunder of the Jerusalemites would be like a spiced and sweet morsel to the enemy. The Babylonians' appetites would be sharpened and become keen because of all that plunder, all that spice in the pot. The plundering of the city of Jerusalem would be as agreeable to the Babylonians as well-seasoned meat would be agreeable to a hungry man. Verse 11, then set the empty pot on the coals. Now, the water has been poured out. When you pour water out of a pot, the water is not available to distribute the heat. As anybody who has left an empty pot on the stove will testify, as I've done that, the pot burns up. God says, set the empty pot on the coals till it becomes hot and its copper glows, so its impurities may be melted and its deposit burned away. Now, that's either the scum that was in there from the people, or it's the rust that's in the pot. Either way, heat produces purity. God's judgment produces purity. However, the previous impurity of the pot, in verse 12, has frustrated all efforts. In other words, all the heat that had been put on the Jerusalemites so far had not worked. Its heavy deposit has not been removed. Assuming that the deposit is scum, like I have assumed, that means the scum overflows and hits the fire, and even the fire does not remove the scum. I guess the scum is all encrusted on the inner side of the pot. And of course, the scum represents the filthiness of the people of Jerusalem. Verse 13, now your impurity is lewdness. We don't have to guess as to the import of the metaphor there. I tried to cleanse you, God says, but you would not be cleansed from your impurity. God sent them many, many prophets. They didn't listen. Judgments they already had in exile in 597. Didn't matter. They didn't pay any attention. You will not be clean again until my wrath against you has subsided. In other words, until the city is burnt down to the ground. Finally, you're going to get rid of your idolatry, which is true. The Israelites did not practice idolatry from the burning of the city of Jerusalem to the present day. No more idols amongst the Jews. Verse 14, I, the Lord, have spoken. The time has come for me to act. I will not hold back. I will not have pity, nor will I relent. You will be judged according to your conduct and your actions, declares the sovereign Lord. In other words, the time for repentance is over. You have screwed it up. Ezekiel 24, verses 15 through 18. The word of the Lord came to me. This is Ezekiel talking now. And now in verse 16, here's the word of the Lord. Son of man, with one blow I'm about to take away from you the delight of your eyes. Yet do not lament or weep or shed any tears. Groan quietly. Do not mourn for the dead. Keep your turban fastened and your sandals on your feet. Do not cover the lower part of your face or eat the customary food of mourners. So I spoke to the people in the morning, and in the evening my wife died. The next morning I did as I had been commanded. In verse 16, God tells Ezekiel with one blow he's about to take away from Ezekiel the delight of Ezekiel's eyes. That would be Ezekiel's wife. And of course the symbolism is that Jerusalem is going to die just as quickly. Bang! 586, the city's burnt. On the 10th of Av, 586, the fire started, and so the destruction of Jerusalem came very quickly, just as Ezekiel's wife's death did. Now, in verse 16, Ezekiel is told by God to not lament or weep or shed any tears, of course, which is unnatural. Your wife dies, you're going to cry. Now, Adam Clark says that as a priest, Ezekiel was a priest, he could make no public mourning. Clark cites Leviticus 21:1, which says, the Lord said to Moses, speak to Aaron's sons, the priest, and tell them, a priest is not to make himself ceremonially unclean for a dead person among his relatives. And of course, you get around a dead person, you're going to make yourself ceremonially unclean. But Albert Barnes contradicts that. Barnes says that, and I quote, the priest in general was to mourn for his dead, citing Leviticus 21:1 and the following verses, which Clark did not cite. But Ezekiel was to be an exception to the rule. We read in Leviticus 21, verses 2 through 3. Well, let's go back and read verse 1. The Lord said to Moses, speak to Aaron's sons, the priests, and tell them, a priest is not to make himself ceremonially unclean for a dead person among his relatives, verse 2, except for his immediate family, his mother, father, son, daughter, or brother. He may make himself unclean for his young unmarried sister and his immediate family. And, of course, that would include his wife, too, I'm sure, even though the law doesn't state it. And so, I don't think Ezekiel's being a priest had anything to do with him not being allowed to mourn for his wife's death, this is an object lesson that God is presenting to the Jerusalemites. We'll talk about the meaning of that object lesson in just a minute. Now, in verse 17, God tells Ezekiel, "Groan quietly. Do not mourn for the dead." Now, what that means is you can groan to yourself privately in your house, but don't go out and publicly go to a funeral. Don't have a public memorial service. I love how funeral homes now have managed to make us stop saying funerals. We now have to say memorial service. I guess they thought that death being associated with their business was not a good branding move. And now you listen to people, they won't say funeral. It's like it's a dirty word. Groan quietly. Do not mourn for the dead. God tells Ezekiel, keep your turban fastened. Now, a turban is something that covered both the priest's head and also the common people's head. And it's not clear here what kind of turban we're talking about. As Adam Clark said, it could be a covering for priest. The turban may have been for high priest or ordinary priest for their head covering. Or, as Ellicott says, the turban could be a covering for the common people. Let me quote Ellicott. This might be either the covering for the head usually worn by the people, or the special mitre of fine linen, the turban of fine linen, provided for the priest. But as the peculiar priestly garments were worn only when the priests were on duty within the tabernacle, it is not likely that Ezekiel used them in his captivity. And I think that makes a lot of sense, so I think this is just a turban. Now, I wondered whether taking your hat off would be something you would do when you were mourning. But I read somewhere, I didn't write it down on the internet, that I think it was in Judaism 101, that actually covering your head was a sign of mourning. So I'm not really sure what the reference is there, keep your turban fastened. He could refer to the fact that the exiles had to have their heads covered because they had to get out of Jerusalem fast. Remember, this death of Ezekiel is an object lesson. Remember, this death of Ezekiel's wife is an object lesson for the people of Jerusalem. So Ezekiel keeps his turban fastened. That would symbolize to the people of Jerusalem, you better keep your hat on, because you're going to have to leave Jerusalem very quickly because it's burning to the ground. Likewise, when Ezekiel is told to keep his sandals on his feet, the object lesson there is, people of Jerusalem, you better keep your shoes on because you're going to be walking here. You're going to be scattered all out all over the ancient Near East, and most of you are going to Babylon, so you better have your shoes on. At the end of verse 17, God tells Ezekiel, do not cover the lower part of your face. That was a typical mourning custom. As Benson says, quote, covering the lips or face was another token of mourning. And finally, in verse 17, Ezekiel is told by Yahweh not to eat the customary food of mourners. That was typical. People would bring food in, spread it out on the table, and all the mourners would eat. We do that today in our funeral customs. So in verse 18, Ezekiel spoke to the people that morning, and in the evening his wife died. The next morning he did just as he had been commanded. Well, what was that? The next morning he didn't mourn for his wife. He privately grieved, of course, but he didn't go out and go through the funeral rituals. One little detail I left out about the sandals. God tells Ezekiel to keep the sandals on your feet. Walking barefoot was a sign of grief. And so God says, keep your feet covered, you're not going to grieve. And I think, of course, the purpose of that command to keep Ezekiel's sandals on his feet was to show that the people of Jerusalem were going to have to go into exile, and so they were going to have sandals on their feet. We go now to Ezekiel 24, verses 19 through 23. Then the people asked me, this is Ezekiel talking now, and the people say this, won't you tell us what these things have to do with us? So I, that's Ezekiel, said to them, the word of the Lord came to me. Now this is the word of the Lord. Say to the house of Israel, this is what the sovereign Lord says. I am about to desecrate my sanctuary. That's the temple. The stronghold in which you take pride. The delight of your eyes. The object of your affection. The sons and daughters you left behind will fall by the sword. And you will do as I have done. The I there is Ezekiel. You will do as I, Ezekiel, have done. You will not cover the lower part of your face. In other words, you're not going to mourn. That's what mourners did. You're not going to eat the customary food of mourners. That's what mourners did, but you're not going to mourn. Verse 23, you will keep your turbans on your heads and your sandals on your feet, because you're going to have to leave Jerusalem very quickly. Of course, now he's talking to the exiles. The exiles have already left Jerusalem, but they stand for the Jews who are back in Jerusalem. You will not mourn or weep, but will waste away because of your sins and groan among yourselves. In other words, you'll groan privately, but you're not going to have any public mourning ceremony for the temple because everything will be such disaster. You will be so stunned, the normal mourning rituals will not apply. Now, in verse 21, God tells Ezekiel to say to the house of Israel, that would include those who were in Jerusalem as well as those who were in Babylon. So messengers would have to be sent to Jerusalem so they would get the word, bad word, I'm about to desecrate my sanctuary. That sanctuary to the Jews was as dear and desirable to the Jews as Ezekiel's wife was to him. But they're not going to cry for it. They won't have time. They'll be in shock. Now in verse 21, Ezekiel is to say to the people, the stronghold in which you take pride will be desecrated. He refers to the sanctuary of the temple as the stronghold. The King James has the strength. John Gill says that if you translate it that way, the strength would refer to the Jews' king and kingdom, their princes and nobles, their soldiers and men of might and war, their wealth and substance, their city and the inhabitants of it, or rather their temple. I think it refers to their temple. I think that's the easiest way to take that. Now, at the end of verse 21, Ezekiel is to tell the Jews that the sons and daughters you left behind. Now he's speaking to the Jews in exile in Babylon because the sons and daughters you left behind were the ones that were left behind in Jerusalem. They're going to die. They're going to fall by the sword. Verse 22, and you will do as I have done. In other words, I have not mourned when my wife died, and you're not going to mourn when the temple dies. You will not cover the lower part of your face, eat the customary food of mourners. Now, I've been giving you the reason why the Jews would not mourn because they would be in shock. Another reason is if you are in Babylon and you start mourning because of what the Babylonians did, that would probably not be a good career move because the Babylonians are probably not going to appreciate that. You're mourning for what we, the Babylonians, did? What's the matter with you people? So, verse 23, you, and this is referring to the Jews in Jerusalem, will keep your turbans on your head, your sandals on your feet, because you're going to go into exile. You're going to need a head covering and a foot covering. You will not mourn or weep. You won't have time, but you will waste away because of your sins and groan among yourselves. Your grieving will be private and not public. We go now to Ezekiel 24, verses 24 through 27, and we will be finished with this audio. This is Yahweh speaking to the Jews. Ezekiel will be a sign to you. You will do just as he has done. In other words, you're not going to mourn. When this happens, you will know that I am the sovereign Lord. And you, son of man, on the day I take away their stronghold, their joy and glory, the temple, the delight of their eyes, their heart's desire, and their sons and daughters as well, on that day a fugitive will come to tell you the news. That would be a fugitive from the burning city of Jerusalem. Make his way to Babylon to tell the exiles exactly what happened. Verse 27, at that time your mouth will be opened. You will speak with him and will no longer be silent. So you will be a sign to them, and they will know that I am the Lord. In verse 27, the mouth of the Jews will be opened, that is to speak to the messenger to find out what's going on. John Gill says of this, from this time to the taking of Jerusalem, which was about 18 months, remember we're at 588, Jerusalem went down in 586. This is the winter of 588, and Jerusalem went down in the summer of 586, so that's about 18 months, as Gill says. The prophet had nothing to say to the people of the Jews, and so was dumb with respect to them, but was employed in prophesying against other nations, as the following chapters show, until chapter 33, in which we have an account of the messenger that escaped to Ezekiel. But after that, Ezekiel's mouth was opened, and he prophesied to them again. So that kind of gives us a foreshadowing of what we're going to be tackling in the upcoming chapters. Now let's finish off this chapter with a question. How is Ezekiel's lack of mourning a sign to the Israelites? That's not as obvious as it might seem. I'll give you three opinions on that. Here's option number one. The Israelites didn't love Jerusalem like they should. I got this from a website called HereAddsTruth.com, which is weird. They didn't love Jerusalem like they should, so they wouldn't mourn for her. I don't think that's correct. I think they loved Jerusalem, well, maybe for the wrong motives, but they still loved that temple. I mean, it was their national identity. So they might not have loved Jerusalem for the right motives, but they did love her. They loved Jerusalem for reasons of nationalism, not love for Yahweh. So I don't think that's the reason that they didn't mourn because they didn't love Jerusalem. Let's go to option number two. This is the option that I mentioned earlier. The destruction of Jerusalem was so stunning, the Israelites would be in shock, and thus incapable of public mourning. This is from gotquestions.org, and I think that's exactly what happened. They were in shock. And not to mention the fact that the city was burnt down, it's kind of hard to do public things when the city's burning. Of course, they could mourn in Babylon, so there were no practical hindrances to mourning the destruction of Jerusalem in the exile community in Babylon. So I think that the real reason they didn't mourn is because they were in shock. Here's another reason. Option number three, why they didn't mourn. The Israelites in captivity in Babylon couldn't mourn publicly because the Babylonians probably wouldn't be too happy about that. I mentioned that earlier. That might be a reason, but I don't think that's the major reason. The main reason is because, by golly, this was an incredible event to watch Jerusalem go up. Jerusalem was going to be the capital of the world, but the Messiah was going to come back to, and now it's a smoking ruin. Ladies and gentlemen, on that awesome note, we are now finished with Ezekiel 24, and we are prepared in our next audio to go to Ezekiel 25, which I will entitle Prophecies Against Ammon, Moab, Edom, and Philistia, these typical surrounding nations of Israel that are mentioned over and over again in the prophecies. Ezekiel has finished denouncing Jerusalem. Now he's going to start denouncing the enemies of Jerusalem. I hope to see you in our next audio for that, and I hope you enjoyed this one.